Can have a seat, and if you have a copy of the scriptures, I invite you to turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 7, which is where we'll be this morning. Just wanted to share, you heard in the announcements about the golf outing and Greg Holt, who oversees and kind of leads and organizes the outing, will be out in the gathering space during both hours if you have any questions. But I wanted to share a little bit more about the outing, because it's different this year in that the benefit towards the golf outing is towards a local ministry called Friends of Recovery. And part of why that is significant is because it's local, and Dennis Anthony, who's the director of Friends of Recovery, he's working to get people to come to it as well. And he's actually gotten four additional sponsors to the event. So it's going to really fill up this year. He's going to bring new people. I already have my foursome, and two of them aren't part of Trinity. So I want to encourage you not just to save the money today, but if you're considering to go, make sure to get your spot in, because it could fill up maybe quicker than we're used to. So I just wanted to encourage you to do that. Ecclesiastes chapter 7 is where we'll be this morning. And I want you to consider a couple of questions I have. I want you to think back into your earliest memories. Do you remember the first movie that you saw? The first time you went to a theater? I think for me, it was Bambi. I don't know if that was the first one, but it was traumatic. So, you know, Bambi's pretty dark at the beginning. So what about, do you remember the first time you got on an airplane? And where you went? I went to the exotic location of New Jersey. You went to a funeral. First time you walked in and saw someone you loved in a box. You remember that? I can remember my earliest experience. It was my great grandfather, who I did not know very well. But it was early on, because I can barely remember much, but I feel like I remember my mother driving us to the funeral home and kind of telling us, or telling me, kind of what to expect, trying to prepare me for what a funeral was, what it was all about, and things. And I feel like she even kind of said at some point beforehand, you know, if you don't want to go, you don't have to. And you know, whenever there's a first, there's always that part of you, right? That's like, I could skip it. I don't have to go. I kind of want to see what is this new experience that all of us are going to go through, even at a young age, recognizing. I feel like I have to, or I should. But those moments in life come to us all inevitably, and every so often when they do, it's the question we ask, right? Do I have to go? Is this something I should skip? Is there a way to just kind of glide past this? And I think the book of Ecclesiastes is going to address this. We're going to just read aloud the first four verses in Ecclesiastes. He says, "A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house." Author of Ecclesiastes, see, this is why no one likes you. It's things like this that you write that we don't want to hear, and that sounds so bizarre. The house of mourning better than the house of feasting? Sorrow better than joy? What are you talking about? We all know and have experienced that not to be the case. He uses these three better thans throughout this. Day of death better than day of birth. House of mourning better than house of feasting. Sorrow better than laughter. I'll take laughter anytime, right? So what's he saying? Well, I don't think he's saying that a life filled with funerals would be preferable to a life filled with birthday parties. I don't think he's saying that. I think what he's saying is trying to point out and recognize that life is filled with things, good things and bad things. And whichever comes, we have to enter into whichever moment that is. You remember last week, we talked about Ecclesiastes being a book of wisdom literature, and that in wisdom literature, there was constantly the contrast between wisdom and folly. And last week we mentioned that folly can be described in two words, impulse and appetite. And that the path of folly is one that wants to just go down the happy path, the happy trail where your appetites are always satisfied and it's all good and it's just nothing but joy all the time. And I think what the teacher is trying to show us is that that is not going to be the case. Life will be filled with times of sorrow and mourning and pain. And when those times come, you can't just keep running to the next party. You can't just keep going to the feast of satisfaction, because you're going to miss out on understanding life. If you play the role of father, and I think more and more, we have a hard time with that in our culture. I think we have actually, fortunately, lived in a world and in a society where we are so removed from pain and discomfort, and particularly from the ultimate demonstration and reminder of pain and sorrow, discomfort, death. We're grateful for medical advances and all of these things, and yet we still cannot avoid it. It's interesting to look at the history of those who provide the services around the departed, to look at the history of funerals and those who are in the profession, because it used to be something that was pretty much done mostly by the family, at least in America. But what really changed that was the Civil War, when so many young men went away from the house, did not die of old age, did not die in the home, but died on the battlefield. And then they wanted to get these individuals from the battlefield to a home in order for the families to be able to grieve, mourn the loss, and to bury. And so that's when embalming actually became a popular practice in the United States. And when embalming really took off is when Lincoln was assassinated, and they embalmed him and took him on a kind of traveling funeral by train throughout the U.S. in order for the nation to collectively mourn and see and experience the loss of their president. And once President Lincoln became embalmed, embalming became really the common practice. And in order to do that, you need a professional. And so then it became a recognition of just kind of having a one-stop shop, where all of it's done. Instead of having the service in the home, now you have a place separate where they'll embalm and they'll take care of everything. It used to be that and the body would be on display in a part of the home called the parlor. And so when they began to develop these areas where the professionals would take care of it, they called it the funeral parlor in order to help that translation occur. Then in the 20th century, a magazine said, we don't like this part of the house named parlor. It sounds so dreary. We're not going to call it parlor anymore. We're going to call this part of the house the living room. It's no longer the room of the dead. And so now we've taken death out of the home. And then the funeral homes continued to, well, they moved and said, well, we don't want that word parlor either. So they changed to funeral homes, continuing to keep up with the marketing. As we go into the later 20th century, there just became this boom and this growth of cremation happening. And so funeral services and funeral homes were worried that they would lose business. And so they began to contract and make sure that they were connected with some type of cremation service, either building crematoriums along with their services or contracting out. And so they maintained the relationship and were able to maintain their services to those who were experiencing loss. And it makes you wonder, as we have removed death from our homes and we've extended the amount of death we'll see, what's next? And one of the things that I see is that we're seeking to remove death as much as possible out of our lives. We've already removed death out of our homes. And I wonder if the next step is to move death out of our language. Think of the last time you went to a funeral. Did they ever use the word dead or death? Or was there another word that was used that would kind of loosen the blow? And in fact, I think what we see more and more often is not even calling it a funeral or a memorial service, but a celebration of life. Celebration. And you might be saying, Ty, you're taking this too far. Well, I went onto a funeral home website, and this is true, it's online, and they offer personalized celebration of life services and give recommendations for ways that you can make this celebration of life service very personal to the departed. And here's an example they gave. They said, well, for a baseball fan, this could mean not only a ball and glove placed in the casket, but also an organist playing Take Me Out to the Ball Game at the start of the service. Attendees could be asked to wear team t-shirts and be treated to hot dogs, peanuts, nachos, and beer afterward. Maybe everyone goes home with a baseball cap emblazoned with their loved one's name and dates of life. Really, I was on a website. You might think, well, people aren't actually doing that, right? There is actually one woman who, when her husband died, she ordered a gaming theme. He was a big gambler. And so for his funeral, when her husband died for his celebration of life service, the area was decorated complete with authentic slot machines discreetly positioned around a neon-lit casket, gambling chips the size of manhole covers, and a jumbo deck of cards in lieu of a flower spray covering the deceased. And instead of folding chairs, jumbo-sized dice served as ottomans. So the question remains, are we seeking to continue to try to remove the pain of death from our lives in ways that ultimately are just band-aids? It doesn't matter how many slot machines surround the grave or how brightly lit up that casket is or how much the service related to the things that the person loved in life at the end of the day. The seeming injustice of death and pain that we experience. And I think the writer of Ecclesiastes is warning us, don't just go from party to party. That's not what a full life looks like. A full life looks like one that is willing to go into the house of mourning and be willing to experience the pain of life. I think we tend to do this in every area of life where we seek to just want to focus on comfort and joy and satisfaction. And death is the ultimate picture that reminds us it's not all fun. We can't dance through everything. I was reminded of the musical Wicked. And in the musical Wicked, there's a character, Fiero. And when he's introduced, he demonstrates this exact mindset, that he wants to live a life that is unexamined. Don't look at life. Don't look deep. Just dance through life. This is the song that he sings. He says, dancing through life, skimming the surface, gliding where turf is smooth. Life's more painless for the brainless. Why think too hard when it's so soothing dancing through life? No need to tough it when you can stuff it off as I do. Nothing matters, but knowing nothing matters. It's just life, so keep dancing through. Fiero really well summarizes the path of the fool. It's just life. Let's just try to keep dancing through. And I love what John Eldridge said when he was talking about how we deal with pain and sorrow and mourning in our life, in the role that it has and how it grows, shapes, and transforms our soul. Because what he said is, he says, the human soul is restored by comfort. Comfort's great, comfort, but we love for more and more comfort. And there's nothing wrong with that when it's the right time. But things are filled with other things as well in life. A few years ago, my father had a car, a Lincoln MKS. He racked up about 150,000 miles on it. So instead of trading it in, he gave it to me. It was great. It was a Lincoln luxury car. It was so nice. Had a sunroof, Sirius satellite, leather seats. When you would turn on another road, the headlights would follow where you were turning. And so I tried my hardest to keep that thing going as long as it could. I mean, when I would make that turn, yeah, the lights would follow, but if it had been raining, like water would leak from the moonroof onto my leg. And I would tell my daughter, it's just character, it's okay. But she wasn't amused as she sat in the passenger seat with her feet up because puddles were forming in the floorboard. Finally, the transmission died on it. And so that was the end of the car and the end of all of the luxury. Not only did it have heated seats, it had air-conditioned seats. And I want you to think about this. If you think, is the world seeking to shape us in a life of comfort? I had a car that was designed to air-condition my butt. That is where we are in a society. We want as much as comfort, as much as possible, in as many places as possible. And that's great. That's fine. But we can't forget that there's going to be houses of mourning and moments of sorrow. And those moments are times that will teach us wisdom and that will grow our souls. And we must be willing to enter in it. And I want to give three examples. What does the house of mourning remind us of? What does it actually teach us? And I want us to look at some passages I think that the house of mourning reminds us of whenever we must enter into it, is it reminds us that we are fragile. In John chapter 4, he's speaking to the woman at the well, and he says to her this. He says in verse 13, Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." Every time we take a drink of water, it's a reminder we're going to need more. We need water to survive, something so basic, and yet we must have it. Life is filled with fragility, and Jesus reminds the woman at the well, "You're fragile. You keep coming for this water, but guess what? I have something better to give you." The fragility of life points to somewhere, reminds us of this hunger for its ultimate satisfaction. If you want to know if you're fragile, just continue to go for your annual checkups at your doctor. I went this past year for my annual checkup for my doctor, and he did something he had never done before. It's not what you think. I was laying flat on my back and he grabbed my ankle and he just pulled it up. He said, "I just want to see how flexible you are." And he said, "You're pretty tight." And, you know, I was always one of those guys, and I still am. Whenever you go exercise, you don't stretch beforehand. You just go after it and you run, right? And I mean, I remember I was in my 20s playing church league softball. And there was this guy out in the field on the other team, and he was like church league softball guy, you know, really trim and fit and had those like spandex short shorts, not pants, because softball guy wears like the shorts. You know what I'm talking about? Those shorts. So he's out there playing and you can tell and the guys have to carry him. Like he was just jogging down a fly ball and poof, hamstring pop. We are fragile. And there is times in life where we will be reminded of that. Now, Jesus, in his teaching to the woman at the well, reminds us these times of fragility in life serve to remind us that there is a greater longing that we desire that only he can fulfill. Second thing we see In times of a house of mourning, it reminds us that you are not in control. Look in Luke chapter 12. Jesus is telling a parable in chapter 12, verse 16. And he says, and he told them a parable saying, the land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, what shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops. And he said, I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God. In that parable, Jesus is reminding us that not that it's wrong to prepare, but that it is wrong to prepare without a proper perspective of who's actually in control and how much control do I actually have over the things in my life. We all know that over the past 2 years, there were probably lots of plans that we had set in stone that we thought for sure were going to happen. Nothing could have changed. A variety of things have changed. And it's a reminder, life is fragile. And we really are not nearly as much in control as we think. Every time we enter into a house of mourning or a moment of sorrow, it's a reminder, really don't have that much control over things. The good news is we know the one who does. Third thing that we always are mindful of when we enter the house of mourning is that you are more. Here's what I mean. Look at Matthew chapter 10. In Matthew chapter 10, verse 29, Jesus says this, "In are not two sparrows sold for a penny? And not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father, but even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, therefore, you, for you are of more value than many sparrows." When death comes, it's a reminder to all of us, there's something more. Oftentimes, even the most skeptical and cynical, when the day of death arrives in their life, either through experiencing others, the questions that they've had that they've pushed aside or that they've suppressed often continue to reemerge. And it's one of the most significant questions of life we have to ask. Are we more than just this? It was a 4th of July when my uncle was 16. He was preparing his own fireworks show. And so he had a lead pipe and he's breaking off match heads and he's sticking the match heads in the lead pipe. Heads of the match heads pushes against the side of the lead pipe. Boom. And for my whole life, I knew my Uncle Frank as this. He lost 1.5 fingers. But here's the question. When my Uncle Frank lost those parts of his body, did he become less Frank? What if he lost more? Would he have become less Frank? We recognize that we are not simply what we are constituted physically. In fact, if you continue to look further and further into our lives and into our bodies at a very microscopic level, we're made up of cells, and all cells only have a life of so long, and then they're replaced. It's actually about 7 years. So you are literally not the same person you were 7 years ago. Is that all we are? Is these cells? Or is there something greater than that? Something beyond that. It's the house of mourning that always comes up as an abrupt reminder to consider these very important questions. And it's worth not simply skipping through. In Ecclesiastes 3:11, the teacher writes, "He has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also put eternity in their hearts. But no one can discover the work God has done from beginning to end." There is this constitution within our hearts that the teacher says eternity is placed in there. And there's this knowledge and this recognition that life is more and that we are more. And so often, comfort can suppress that and just want us to continue to move on from the next thing. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verses, "Consider the work of God, for who can straighten out what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that no one can discover anything that will come after him." Both prosperity and adversity, they have their moments and they have their uses and they have their part in our life to shape us. And we can't just hope for and continue to move on from prosperity to prosperity. And as the people of God, I believe our calling and our responsibility is to demonstrate to a world that just wants to dance through life the way to walk into the house of mourning and what it means to experience God, not only in prosperity, but also in adversity. You know, the National Institutes of Health has been in the news a lot more over the past year than it has been in a long time. The president, the director of the National Institute of Health, is a man named Francis Collins. And when Francis Collins was preparing for a field of science and medicine, he was essentially an agnostic. He had no belief in God or no confidence in the afterlife or any of those things. But what began to change in his life is as he was serving in his medical service, and going around and talking with people, there was one lady in particular who was on death's door. And her confidence in what was to come, and her confidence in her understanding and perspective on eternity shook him. And she pointed him. And it started him on this journey of faith in coming to a place where he trusted in Christ and recognized that life is more than cells. He actually was part of mapping the Human Genome Progress program. So if anyone knows cells, it's him. In the experience of seeing someone who knew very little about how all of the inner workings of the cell operated, this was a very simple woman. But she had wisdom. And her wisdom was about the stuff that Ecclesiastes is talking about, the way she carried herself in the house of sorrow. And he says, "I don't have an answer for that." And it reminds me of Psalm 23, because the Psalms are filled with what should be our life experience, the way we walk through life and the way we carry ourselves. When the psalmist writes, "Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters." Oh, we like that. We love green pastures and we love still waters. You notice what the psalm says in there? Green pastures, still waters. He restores my soul. Those times restore our soul. But it's not all green pastures and still waters, is it? And even the psalmist recognized that, because he says, "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death," what does he say next? "I'll fear no evil because you are with me." In adversity, in prosperity, we have an opportunity to understand the presence of God in ways we can't understand in both. What we learn in the valley of the shadow of death is not what we learn beside still waters and green pastures. And so what I want to invite you to this morning, wherever he has placed you today, think of that passage in Ecclesiastes 13. Are you in a season of prosperity? Are you at green pastures and still waters? Rejoice. Enjoy it. He is restoring your soul. Are you walking through the valley of the shadow of death? Don't skip past that house. Don't just look for the next feast, but lean into that house and be willing to learn whatever God would have you learn in that moment so that you can understand in a unique way what the psalmist said as well. I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Join me in praying. God, we thank you for the wisdom of your word that relates so specifically to the areas of life that we all will enter into. I pray for those of us who are in the house of feasting, who are enjoying times of green pastures and still water. And we thank you for those moments and restore our souls. God, I pray for those who in their season of life right now are walking through a valley of the shadow of death. And I pray that they will experience the comfort of your rod and your staff as you shepherd them through it. May they have the confidence that even if they do not feel it, and even if it seems like you are absent, that they will need not fear evil because you are with them. And I pray that as a people, in times of prosperity and in times of adversity, may we show all around us your goodness, your love, and the way in which you walk with us. In your name we pray, amen.